A very cruel reality of being an elite athlete is that when you're earning money, it kind of falls off a cliff once you finish being an elite athlete. And already we were kind of living in terms of like opportunities with sponsorships and things like that. They're big chunks of money very infrequently, which is already a bit scary to deal with because you're having to really be very strong on budget. But when I retired, those big lumpy chunks of money disappeared.
That's Libby Trickett, who made a huge transition from gold medal winning swimmer to co-founding counsellor at Unlocking Her Potential. And this is WNA Trailblazers.
WNA.
Women's Network Australia.
Trailblazers. Amplifying the stories of women in business. Hosted by Women's Network Australia CEO Cheryl Gray and Louise Poole, me, managing partner of podcast production company and official Women's Network Australia media partner, Welcome Change Media. Ever tried to change career midstream, only to find it all too hard and end up back where you started? The longer we do something, the greater the risk of us being tempted to fall back into our old groove when opportunity knocks. Trailblazer Libby Trickett knows all about this, and together with husband Luke, chat to Cheryl, telling their stories about what happened when they made a significant change in their careers. Cheryl, it must be quite a unique experience doing something like winning gold medals, being the best in the world when you're 23, and then asking what happens next when you've got your whole life ahead of you.
It's pretty challenging, isn't it? Because I can imagine for someone who has been at the top of their game and found it, dare I say, pretty easy, not taking away anything from the amount of hard work and dedication and everything that goes into training, but that it came pretty naturally to Libby. And then to kind of decide that, yes, my swimming days are over and here comes life, and really not being prepared for what's out there and how to make that transition from being a professional athlete to being a mum, working and everything that goes with the day-to-day life would have been a real shock. What I really loved about talking with Luke and Libby is the challenges that they went through, both individually, but they dealt with them together. And that's obviously a really important part of, you know, any sort of successful relationship, is being able to share those challenges and talk about them and support each other. It's part of the reason that organisations like Women's Network Australia exist, because we are there to listen and to hear what those challenges are and help talk it through and come up with some solutions. And most importantly, make people understand that they're not alone. They're not the first person who's transitioned from elite swimming to life, but it always feels like that at the time, as it did for Libby. An amazing conversation with the two of them, and they've both got incredible stories to tell.
It's absolutely amazing too that they're so honest and authentic in sharing those highs and lows along their journey of preparing for change and transition. So Cheryl, let's dive in.
Let's dive in.
It's hard to go past an Olympic gold medal. That is an incredible experience and an incredible honour to be part of, either individually winning a gold medal at the Olympics or a relay. But for me, one of the most memorable and the most proud moment, I think, of my swimming career was actually the 4x2 relay at the World Short Course Championships in 2006. And there's a bit of a story behind it. So it was an incredibly busy year for swimming that year. And in January, we had the Commonwealth Games trials, which actually landed on my 21st birthday. I competed at the Commonwealth Games trials, got selected on the Australian team, went and competed at the Commonwealth Games in March that year, and then had a very successful campaign, but, you know, started to really start feel the pressure and expectation from media, from the Australian public in terms of how many gold medals I was going to win. It was kind of talked about that I was going to win 7 gold medals at that Commonwealth Games, which was kind of a weird feeling because I hadn't actually competed in, I think, 2 or 3 of those events at an international level at that stage. But here I was, they were telling me that I was going to win 7 gold medals. First day of competition, I got silver in the 200 meters freestyle, which I was stoked with, But also it meant that I was going to fail at the 7 gold medals. And I ended up walking away with 5 gold medals, which is nothing to sneeze at. I was
How disappointing.
I know. What a disappointment, right?
Unbelievable.
But I know. I should have just walked away and hung my head in disgrace. But, you know, I kept on keeping on. And I actually, off the back of those Commonwealth Games, I got told that I tested with too high testosterone. So I hesitate in saying the word positive for testosterone because that turned out not to be the case. But I had to go through this entire process of worried that I had tested positive for high levels of testosterone and go through the process of actually proving that that was my natural level that I had just because of how my body is genetically made up. And I had to go and show all of my drug test results from when I was 15 years of age to then when I was 21. So it was this really deeply traumatic because like the idea of testing positive for anything and being called a drug cheat was just so against who I was as a person and everything that I wanted to be as a role model in swimming. And this all happened within a week off the back of the Commonwealth Games. And then I had to go to the World Short Course Championships. Thankfully, obviously, they showed that I hadn't tested positive, that, you know, that was all part of the normal level.
The level was acceptable. Yeah.
Correct. Correct. And that the difference was for testing positive that year was that the Commonwealth Games had brought the level that they were comfortable with down for that particular meet. So managed to go and swim at the World Short Course Championships. And it was one of the first races that I got to compete in China. And I had this moment where, I mean, I was so unbelievably nervous. Swimming 200 meters for a sprinter is scary at the best of times, let alone trying to compete on the world stage with 3 other incredible Australian women who are all, you know, wanting the same outcome. And we were by no means the favorite at that stage to win. And actually the Chinese team were definitely the favorite. And I was going to bring the team home. So the first couple of Australians led off. We were in second position. The Chinese team were easily winning when I dove in. And before I dove in, the crowd was electric. You can imagine the Chinese team is in the lead. The entire stadium was just lifting the roof off because they were so excited about potentially winning a gold medal. And I managed to dig deep. My strengths are my starts and my turns and my finishes. So I was confident in my ability, but I just swam with everything that I could give in that moment and managed to just touch the Chinese girl on the wall. And it was amazing because initially the crowd went up because they thought that their team had won, but they immediately realized that the Australian team actually touched the wall first. And it was like a pin could drop in that stadium because they were so disappointed. And obviously we were elated in that moment. And it was just, it's one of those moments for me that almost nobody knows about, right? You know, the World Short Course Championships is not something that is televised or really, unless you're a diehard swim fan, that the majority of people would know or have heard about. But that moment for me with my team and with my teammates who knew what I had kind of gone through to get there, with my coach, obviously Luke as well, it was that moment that I just really got to relish in what I'd been able to achieve in conjunction with three other incredible Australian women.
Really interesting that that's the time and the event that stands out so clearly for you because of what was going on, not in the pool, but what had been going on in the background and what that was obviously doing to you emotionally, as well as then trying to somehow get through that, get past that, and just focus on performance in the pool.
Well, and I think, you know, there's so much conversation right around athlete mental health, and I'm so proud that as a community, we've been able to start to have these really open and honest conversations and communication around how we are humans first. And Kyle Chalmers really is kind of spearheading that at the moment with all of the kind of challenges he's had within the media landscape this year. And at the end of the day, regardless of who you are, whether you're an athlete, whether you're a business person, small business owner, an employee and an employer, we're all facing stuff at home. We're all having to cope with everything and then perform whatever our roles are. You know, it could even just be a mother, wife, friend, sister, brother, whatever it might be. And that all contributes to how we see and feel ourselves and ultimately the performance in those roles.
Why are we still getting the transition from sport so wrong? We've known about this for a long time, and yet it still seems that we're putting a lot of science, a lot of technology, a lot of money into supporting our elite athletes, and indeed all our athletes, through their sporting careers. And we talk about how important the transition is, but there still seems to be something missing. It just seems remarkable that we're still learning the lessons.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting conversation, and I could literally talk about this for hours. But I mean, at the end of the day, a lot of it comes down to money. When are we as athletes making the money for the organizations that we're working for, right? And the reality is that we stop making the organization money when we retire, essentially. So, you know, there's a lot of things that can be done. And thankfully, there's a lot more conversations around how to set athletes up for retirement. I feel like we're having the conversations now, which is great. But now we need to really get the athletes as many opportunities while they are competing. And, you know, for me, having gone through my experience and seeing the comparison to Luke and his experience in retiring from swimming, he found something that he loved before he finished his sport, and he had something that he was passionate about. And for him, that transition was a lot smoother and a lot easier because he had something. He had a structure and an idea, a way to put his energy into something straight after he finished his sport.
Did you have a plan?
I'm basically the John Farnham of the swimming world. So I had a couple of retirements, a bit of a comeback tour. And so I retired the first time. I was wholly unprepared. I thought I was ready for the real world, and I dropped into definitely a depressive period because I had lost all of my identity. I'd lost my, how to value myself. I had no structure or routine. We were living in Sydney at the time. I had no kind of friendship or family support. So there was a lot of things that kind of were gone during that period of time. And so I went back to swimming. I went back to what I knew and what I understood. And it became a very easy, tangible thing to get me out of that depressed period. And to be perfectly honest, I had every intention of continuing to swim. I went to the 2012 Olympic Games and had the goals and aspirations to go on to Rio in 2016 and make a fourth Olympic. And it's funny because the universe kind of plays its hand. And I ended up getting a catastrophic wrist injury, which after having 10 months out of the water not that long ago, being 27 years of age, potentially looking down the barrel of even more time out of the water, there was also a couple of swimmers, you might have heard of them, called the Campbell sisters, who were coming up the ranks.
Who were they?
And my ego kind of had to really take stock and understand if this was something that was going to be viable for me. And honestly, I think if I hadn't been injured, I would have been pulled kicking and screaming out of swimming. I don't know if I'd ever known the right time to retire again because I was scared of life after sport. It was the best time for me to kind of take those steps, those tentative steps into life after. But I basically went in the second time around with the idea of just trying as many different things as I could. And I realized during that process that it's just as important to learn what you don't want to do as what you do actually want to do. And it's kind of a little bit of a process of elimination, which is hard when you're 27, 28. And a lot of people that you know have spent their early 20s doing just that, trying lots of different things and having different opportunities and doing internships or studying at university. And then, yeah, to kind of do that at the age of 27, 28, that's a big blow to the ego.
The difference too is you've got that competitive streak and that desire to be the best. So I'm sure that added to the types of feelings that you were experiencing.
Yeah. I mean, when you are the best in the world at the age of 23, it's kind of all downhill from there. And I don't say that in
I know what you mean.
But you know, everything is kind of like you feel completely out of place. You can feel, and the thing that I've learned at, you know, the ripe old age of 37 now is that everybody feels like that. Everybody feels like that when they start a new job or they start a new business or moving into parenthood or maybe into grandparenthood. Like there are so many different places where we just are winging it at all times. And I thought it was just me. And the reality is that that's absolutely not true. Most of us have no idea what we're doing. We're basically just trying to do our very best every single day. And it took me a really long time to kind of really appreciate that I wasn't the only one feeling like that at that time.
Luke, can I bring you into the discussion? Because you and Libby obviously met through swimming in one particular meet, I understand, where you were the superstar. Your course has sort of changed in some ways, but you obviously started to make that transition out of swimming a lot earlier, but you were also watching Libby and her career peak in terms of swimming, but then also watching as she obviously began to struggle a bit in making that transition. How did it feel from your perspective? Because I know you obviously would love to have been in the pool there right alongside her all the time, but you were having to make your way in a different pathway, but also watching Libby struggling. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think it was quite so. Liv and I met on our first Australian team at the Oceania Championships. And I think at that point, won swimmer of the meet, which is great. But I just slip that in there.
That's fair enough.
No, thank you. Thank you. I'll take that. But I think it was maybe like 18 months later, I think after that meet, I think maybe Lib, you got bronze in the 100 free at Oceania. Is that right?
Yeah, I got bronze that year.
Yeah, yeah. And then 18 months later, Lib broke the world record in the women's 100 free and qualified for her first Olympic Games. And so like the trajectory between both of us just, you know, hers was basically vertical. That went to the highest level, swimming the fastest that any woman has ever swum in the history of the planet for the blue ribbon event in the pool. So naturally, a lot of attention just landed on Lib's shoulders at the age of 19, I think you were at the time. So while we were both kind of swimming and kind of swimming at that level, the profile was very different and shifted very, very dramatically for Lib quite quickly. That then, like, pretty much stayed there, and it changed. I could see it changed her way of living in a manner where, you know, you enrolled for uni, I think in 2004 as well, but you kind of repeatedly dropped out. You couldn't find the space and the time to complete that course. And there was so many different opportunities coming in at Lib, left, right, and center that were attractive but ultimately distracting in enabling Libby to have the clarity of, like, understand what is it that I'm interested in and want to pursue. And so kind of fast forward over the years, and I didn't have those distractions, unfortunately. I got from swimming the thing that
fortunately or unfortunately, depends how you look at it. Yeah.
I got a wife, so I did extremely well for myself. And now three very spirited young ladies too.
Vibrant.
I wonder where they get that from.
Yeah, you don't know. looking at someone on the call though. You know, so I didn't have that. So it was easy for me to just keep on my path. I finished school and went to uni, studied economics, and just keep following that, and then begun stockbroking of all things. But for Lib, yeah, she had just lots of noise around her world that just made it really hard. So by the time she finished her swimming career, she was like, well, actually, what do I have? Like, nothing really at the end of it. And that's the hard thing. I think for those athletes that get to that top level, we've seen other people in swimming. I know Grant Hackett's been quite open with him or his experiences as well, that get to that point where they've been able to, you know, reach the highest level and earn an income for themselves, but really to the detriment of many other aspects being developed in their life. And so it was hard to watch Lib, you know, over the years, 2009 through to
last year.
Yeah, last year.
Dude, yeah, just about 30 minutes ago.
Yeah. Just before we got on this call. To find that. But I guess, as Lib has mentioned, she tried a bunch of different things. And I just remember, like, head in her hands, I can't even now explain what this business does that I work for. you know, and so it was like very much this obviously continue to support her and encourage her to keep trying different things. And, you know, when like the opportunity for her to pursue something is ready, like, you know, it'll kind of be available. It sounds maybe a bit ephemeral or something, but, you know, the most important thing was just Libby turning up each day, getting ready to try again and keeping an open mind to something coming along that really interests her. And the hard thing, or the thing that kind of compounds that challenge, is particularly as athletes, you focus on one thing and you become entirely blinkered on that one thing.
Yep.
And like it's a kind of endorphins, it's a rush of adrenaline pursuing it and getting better and getting better at it. And that's what she wanted. Again, that's what she obviously had with swimming, and that's what you wanted again, which just made the bar so much higher for whatever it is that Lib wanted to go into. She might have liked something, but it didn't like really grab her. So again, it was just a matter of like just encouraging Lib and making sure that she had the time and space to keep exploring what was going to be her thing to barrel into.
Libby, that feeling, just tell us about what you were going through, that sort of sense of where is my place in this world.
I mean, Luke kind of indicated that, you know, he could only kind of be there to support and kind of give me time and space and grace to have opportunities to try different things. But also a very cruel reality of life and being an elite athlete is that when you're earning money again, it kind of falls off a cliff once you finish being an elite athlete. And that was certainly the case for me. And already we were kind of living in terms of like opportunities with sponsorships and things like that. They're big chunks of money very infrequently, which is already, you know, kind of a bit scary to deal with because you're having to really be very strong on budget. But when I retired, those big lumpy chunks of money disappeared. And Luke had decided that he was going to start a business, which was amazing and great. And I wanted to support him to give him the time and the space and the ability to go and explore that and see if he could make something out of that. But while I was then trying to kind of define my identity and understand who I was, where my passions lay and what my purpose was in this world, I also had to be very clearly making money because I became the primary breadwinner in this situation. And I think that's where that idea of Marmalade was born, because when we needed to get paid, we wanted to get paid immediately. That was something that was really necessary. And we were working with some companies that had like 90-day terms, and, you know, maybe you would get paid after that amount of time, or maybe you wouldn't. It's hard to know, even though you might have done all the work for those particular companies as well.
So essentially, you both fell in a hole, did you not? You both fell in a hole financially and emotionally. Cutting it really, you know, getting to the crux of it, you got to a stage where you were in a bind. What strategies did you use to get out of that?
I'd probably say we were in a really tough position and had been for the years 2012 through to, I'd say, 2017, those 5 years. And over those 5 years, like Lib, I'd started an investment management business that was very small, and so it wasn't producing income for the family. And that's kind of what Lib was saying. She was trying to support me doing that. And she was spinning a lot of plates in that support. It was working at continuing to, you know, engage in those opportunities with sponsorship and endorsements and speaking opportunities, as well as like working at that startup. And so she was doing a lot, and I wasn't bringing much financially to the family.
And that he did earn went straight back into the business.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I don't think that's an unfamiliar scenario.
Yeah.
Exactly right. Yeah. Exactly yeah. Right.
It was brutal. And like we relied on loans. I had loans from my brother and my parents. I think we had at least half a dozen credit cards. We were cycling balance transfers over and over and over with. We applied for loans to the online lenders denied. So what got us through it was two things. One, that I guess we were both communicating and on the same page, even though this is really tough, we were both kind of moving to the same end goal that we were trying to achieve. But there was support, again, which was important, financial support from my brother, my parents, But we were just, I guess it's probably our personalities to just keep grinding when we feel like we've got our clarity on what the goal is that we're working towards. We just keep grinding however long it takes. Swimming's a sport that's perfect for drawing out that kind of personality in people. You know, I think that's the thing that got us through, Cheryl, is the alignment between Lib and myself and just our personalities of grinding through it.
So that real saying about out of adversity comes opportunity, and a couple of opportunities really came out of that. One was the idea around Marmalade, which we'll go to in a moment, but the other one was also you, Libby, in terms of what you perhaps were starting to feel a bit more comfortable around, your body, yourself, and what motivates you as a person and how to really restore your personal capacity to be able to then be the best person you could possibly be. And that's obviously spun into unlocking her potential. So maybe tell us a little bit about that and that journey.
I had this idea at the start of this year that I was going to do a 30-day yoga challenge because I'd just read Atomic Habits by James Clear, which everyone should read. I highly recommend if you haven't already. But it's basically the idea of doing something consistently every day. And I really, for some reason, at that moment resonated deeply with it because I just missed having something that I did every single day from swimming. You know, like I missed having that consistency in my life. I missed working towards something every single day, even though, you know, doing 30 days of yoga is not necessarily to go and compete in the Yoga Olympics, but it was just something for me to look forward to every single day. And it didn't have to be an hour. It didn't have to be perfect. Some days I just literally sat for 2 minutes and did some box breathing on my mat, but it was just setting that intention for every day. And about halfway through that 30 days, I saw an email come into my inbox that said yoga teacher training. And I was like, I feel like I should do that. Like, I don't know what it was, but it really spoke to me in that moment. But I'm like, I really feel like I want to immerse myself more in this. And so I texted my friend Paula, who I had done a number of postnatal programs with. She's a women's health physio. I texted her and said, should I do yoga teacher training? And she basically immediately got back to me and said, yes, 100%, you need to do it. And then about 10 minutes later, she texted me and said, do you want to start a business together? And yeah, basically the rest is history. In February, we started Unlocking Her Potential. And for both of us, from different experiences, we've had a lot of difficult things happen in our lives to do with mental illness. And we both want to lift women up. And basically, women really do carry a lot of the mental load, particularly in heterosexual relationships. And, you know, there's a lot that we do outside of our job. And the fact of the matter is most women are burnt out and we're tired and we're completely overwhelmed and, you know, not just trying to perform as wives or as friends or as family members or as employees. Then we have to look a certain way and then we have to weigh a certain amount and then we have to have all these nice brand names, fancy things that, you know, the media and society tell us that we should be aiming for. And Paula and I just want to break that shit down, mind my language, but we do. We want to break it down because it's not real and that's not how we're going to live full and vibrant lives. We just want to make it really accessible to as many women as possible because we know that these are the things that help women grow and empower themselves and take that fearless aligned action in their lives. And that's the stuff that lights me up and makes me really excited and kind of gets me out of bed every single day.
Luke, for you, it sparked a business idea, which you've been working very hard on, which I think a lot of our listeners in the network will be really keen to hear about, and that is Marmalade. And it really stemmed from looking at that situation where Libby was out doing work and not getting paid at all or being promised that she was going to be paid and you guys having to sit back and wait. Yep, 90 days is a long time for a small business. So just tell us about how that idea came to be and exactly what Marmalade is.
Yeah, like it stemmed from this the nature of Libby's engagements with larger organizations and the cash flows that came from that, which was very lumpy, large amounts that infrequently made their way finally into our bank account. And, you know, in the interim, we had to manage, mortgage repayments. They don't skip a beat. You have to go to the grocery shop and electricity bills and all these things. They never stop. And, you know, you can't pay for your groceries with promises and show them invoices that you've sent to your customers. There was a lot of things that we tried during that period of time, loans from everywhere. It ultimately ended up with us needing to sell our house. And I guess on reflection and going through all of that pain, what I realized was we didn't need another loan. We actually didn't want another loan. Like, we had so many. We had, like, it was hard. I had an Excel spreadsheet of just all of the loans that we had at a point in time. And what we wanted and what we needed, we were crying out for, was just these invoices to be paid. So there was progress being made in lots of different areas, you know, of society. Technology is kind of really empowering a lot of things, us to do a lot. Like, obviously, we're all sitting here talking on Zoom now. There's things that we couldn't imagine to have done even 5 years ago that we are doing just without thought now. And, you know, I was looking at our pain and just reflecting that there has to be a better way for businesses to kind of solve this. What I consider, like, this is the first place that cash flow strain and stress starts in a business. It's from this disconnect between when you acquire inventory or you deliver your goods and services to actually when you get paid. This is where it begins. It's the most kind of brutal aspect of cash flow. And unfortunately, it's the leading cause of business failure. So knowing that we've got new technology, seeing kind of the adoption of cloud accounting software, Xero, MYOB, QuickBooks, they're just available to all small businesses and have been uptaken by all small businesses. Seeing new capabilities, Afterpay and Buy Now, Pay Later has been, you know, it's made an impact in the world. It was interesting to kind of watch these things come together. And I thought, you know what? Why can't there be an invoice payment service that enables people to just be paid when they want to be paid, when they need to be paid? And that's essentially what that is what Marmalade does. We are an invoice payment service. So when you create an invoice, you can choose to have, like, through Xero and these cloud accounting platforms, you can choose to have payment services attached to it. Stripe and PayPal are obviously very well-known examples. And Marmalade is another one. The limitation with Stripe and PayPal is that they just facilitate a payment when the payer has actually decided to pay. But that's, again, as we know, that's not the pain. So Marmalade enables those payments, card, direct debit, and bank transfer. But most importantly, what we do is at the point, if and when you need funds, you need an invoice to be paid, then you can click on a button. We pay the full amount out, less a one-time fee. And then we accept the risk of your customer never paying. So what was important to me, and, you know, from Lib and my experience, was that at that point that the business wants and needs cash flow, the risks aren't elevated and escalated. It's not like, oh, here's another loan. Like, sure, we'll give you some money associated with that invoice, but, you know, that's a liability, and we're going to charge you interest, and, you know, we're going to come back to you if you pay a default. So we wanted to just eliminate all of that messiness, take the risk out of the business. At the time, you know, you need cash. It's like, let's take ante out. Like, let's decrease the risk, give you the cash, let you move forward, and then we accept that credit risk of your customer. And that's essentially how an invoice, I think, should operate, or the tools that should be available to small businesses nowadays with the technology that we have.
Does that mean essentially that waiting around for the 90 days, I can say, yep, I want Marmalade to pay my invoice today?
Yep.
And that you essentially either wait the 90 days or chase up the payer for that money. So rather than me as a provider, I get my money and then you collect it later.
Yeah, absolutely. So
I'm a bit like Libby. You know, it's like, explain it to me in terms I understand. Yeah, but it's not debt of finance. I know it's not that. It's something else. Yeah?
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. So we're not financing. We're not lending any money. At the point you want the invoice paid, you click a button and it's paid out and the funds are remitted to you that same day. And then we wait for the payer to actually make the payment. And if that's on time or late, then there's no clawback or additional fees or charges that are ever kind of levied on you as the supplier of the business. So there's never any additional fees. There's only one fee ever that a business pays for Marmalade, which is that one-time transaction fee at the point where you want that early payment. If the payer is late, obviously there's businesses messy, really, let's be honest. And if, you know, if there's an issue for whatever reason why the invoice isn't being paid, then first things first is we go back to the supplier first and just, you know, through the product, understand, you know, if the supplier, which is the business that wants to be paid early, if they want to, you know, resolve the issue, typically that's our absolute preferred path if there is an issue, and they just run that process. If for whatever reason they're saying, look, there's absolutely no problem, the person should pay, then we more than on the supplier's consent step in and just run through initially it's just an automated reminders of the invoice payment and its due date and all of that, but if the invoice becomes, you know, really overdue, then again, on the business's consent, then we can escalate it through our resources that we have rather than one small business running that process all by themselves. But like for us, we don't want to interfere with a commercial relationship that's already in place. That's important, right? It's important for most businesses that they retain and protect that relationship they have with their customers. We only get involved when, you know, that we've been asked to get involved to help with the collection of the funds. But 9.9 times out of 10, that's just, you know, never occurring.
So Luke and Libby's story, while not necessarily being something that happens to all of us, i.e. we become Olympic champions, I think actually though that experience of throwing ourselves so much into something that it becomes our identity, it becomes our obsession and all we know, and then one day having to transition from that into a quote unquote normal life, there's a lot that we can take out of that story.
There's so much. I think the first thing in relation to Libby is that we all need to reflect on what we expect of our sports people, because we expect them to be amazing at sport, but we also expect them to be amazing at life. And the two don't always go together. And Libby has spent quite a lot of time talking to other athletes and understanding and unpicking their own transition journeys, because it's just too common that we have people who are at the top of their game in sport and we seem to just assume that that will naturally carry over into the rest of their life. And there's no reason in the world why that should be so. But we place such high expectations on them as individuals. And certainly in Libby's case, she expected a lot of herself as well. The other thing is seeing how Libby and Luke have used their experience and tapped into that and identified a problem, which in Libby's case was, you know, the one thing that she had was herself and her brand, and to take that out to market herself. But then not be paid on time, so that they actually had to think about who's going to pay for the shopping or which credit card to use, because they're sort of juggling repayments. Stuff that a lot of so-called average people might be doing, to understand that that is something that so many people out there are having to deal with. So to then go, okay, look, that's a problem. Let's think about how we can fix that. And so then to come up with a business solution that not only would be a great help in that case, but will be a great help to many small businesses out there who really are sweating on invoices being paid to get some cash flow in the door. So hats off to both of them.
Yeah, brilliant idea. How can we best connect with Luke and Libby?
They've both got their businesses. So withmarmalade.com.au is the website where you can find out more about Marmalade, the product and pricing and so forth. And Libby has she's very proud, as you would have heard, in terms of her website, or unlockingherpotential.com.au, where you can jump on and explore the programs and do some, who wouldn't want to work with Libby and do 28 days of yoga and meditation and workout? I think we need to put that on our bucket list, please.
That sounds good, considering we failed at the self-care episode.
Yeah, we did fail at the self-care episode, but there is hope for us yet. That is the message.
And connecting with Women's Network Australia, usual places, womensnetwork.com.au.
Yes, you've got it drummed into you by now, obviously, and of course on all the social media platforms.
And don't forget to give us a follow on the podcast and give us a nice 5-star review to help us get discovered by more people.
And make some suggestions. We want to hear from more amazing, trailblazing women about what they're doing, how they're empowering other women, and you can email us at wna@womensnetwork.com.au.
Next time on WNA Trailblazers.
Talking about money, talking about the value of money and normalising it. We've all got the throwaway lines of money doesn't grow on trees, or you can't be a nice person and have money. But if you've got a really strong belief that you've grown up with that you can't be nice and have money, that could have a really huge impact on your relationship with money and how it's showing up in your life.
Founder and CEO of Talking Money, Rebel Money Coach Melissa Ma, joins us to talk about how reframing our relationship to money can change our lives. Women's Network Australia Trailblazers, amplifying the stories of women in business. Follow us from this podcasting app and be the first to hear new episodes. Do you know a trailblazing woman in business whose story needs to be amplified? Let us know. Drop us a line on the Contact Us page at womensnetwork.com.au. Thinking about making your own podcast? Welcome Change Media would love to help. Visit welcomechangemedia.com.au. WNA Trailblazers is a Welcome Change Media production.